Yeah, no, nighttime temperatures have a huge impact on human health. Actually, one piece of research that I'm doing right now is trying to understand the impacts of extreme heat on neonatal health outcomes and on expecting parents. And when you have very high nighttime heats, that can disrupt sleep cycle. It can have very disastrous impacts for just a person's overall health, especially if there's already comorbidities. So the best solution there is just to have access to cooling in your house, making sure that you are able to, be or sleep in a place that has cooler temperatures when you are experiencing those extreme nighttime heat temperatures. That's the best solution. Yeah, it's hard to trust the electric grid here in Houston. I know. Yeah, they haven't really been able to kind of meet the needs of Houston citizens, especially when it comes to these like events where you have a huge extreme strain on the grid. It's disappointing.
This is a question for Dan Potter. And why is Galveston County not included in the GHCP?
We're not there yet. We started with the Houston Harris County, and we made our first expansion into Fort Bend and Montgomery County, reflecting two of the fastest growing counties in the entire country. Our ultimate goal is to have a greater coverage of the entire area, which is going to include things like Galveston, Brazoria County as well. Also looking out west at Waller, potentially even east in Chambers.
This one is for Dr. Bungie. What is the cheapest and easiest thing the average citizen can do to combat climate change?
Ooh, really throwing the hard ones to me.
That's the answer.
It's a really difficult question. There are individual choices you can make to help mitigate climate change, but overall, I think it's a structural, systematic issue, right? Like, we're relying on, our society is mostly relying on fossil fuels. I think one of the best ways that we can combat climate change is reach out to our representatives, it can feel very hopeless sometimes, but there has to be some extreme drastic change to the way that we operate our energy sector. There has to be in order to deal with climate change.
I can give some individual tips, right? Drive less, drive a fuel efficient car, combine your trips, turn your air conditioning down slightly in the summertime. So all these things are little, but they're things individuals can do. And then also go out and volunteer and get involved in a native plant garden, get involved in a rain garden, get involved in planting marsh grass, get involved in you are involved for being here tonight. So that's the first step right there. So I think, yes, there's institutional stuff that has to happen, but we can't give up on the idea that, individually we should be making some improvements as well.
Okay, I see a common theme for one topic. I'm going to try to pick the best question that represents it. What is a simple, approachable message we can give to people that do not believe these are climate deniers and so forth? And one question is related to is, how do I talk to somebody like that? How do I talk to my relatives like that? You're a good one.
Sort of hog here, but has everybody heard of Catherine Hayhoe? She's a scientist, a professor. She works for the Nature Conservancy now. She literally does YouTube videos on exactly this. So I don't think I could do a good job describing it. I think you can go watch a couple of her 5 or 10 minute videos, and she's got a whole series on talking to your community, talking to your church, talking to your mother-in-law, all these things.
And how do you spell her last name?
Hayhoe. H-A-Y-H-O-E, and it's Catherine with a K. She works for the Nature Conservancy now, but she was a professor at Texas Tech for many years. And she is wonderful at communication, specifically on climate change. And so go on her YouTube page. I'm not joking. You know, you will love it if you care about this issue. So that's, I don't mean to punt, but she's just so wonderful at it.
I advise asking questions rather than try to lecture or tell people or present facts. Just ask questions about how are you perceiving the change in the weather? When was the last time you saw a storm like Harvey or Beryl? Why don't you trust the science? And just let people talk themselves out. I mean, this is what I do for a living, is I interview people. And the first thing I tell young reporters is that when you set an appointment to talk to someone, you sit down to talk to someone about a topic, they've got an agenda in their head of all the things that they plan to tell you. And you need to let them get all of that out. And then you can start talking. And then, you know, so it's very important to listen and to question and to be, I said, a good listener. Because when people talk it out, they will oftentimes reach their own conclusions and realize that maybe they should question what they've heard or what they've been told to believe by Fox News or whatever. But, you know, I do know that going straight at them, that never works.
Yeah, I think the other part of it is playing the game of semantics with people can put folks in a very defensive position. Whereas, again, to build off this idea of asking questions and just having that conversation on their terms. And it doesn't need to be about quote-unquote climate change. It can be as simple as, boy, that storm was wild. Yes, it was. Huh, I wonder how we could do more to, and yes, I'm making a little bit of a fictitious space there, but by not engaging in this war of words and semantics, there is almost certainly more overlap in concerns that people share, wanting a future in which we are not crossing our fingers. Ooh, is the grid gonna hold up this time? Where we're not feeling threatened by every storm that's moving through the area. I don't know that you're gonna find a ton of people who are like, no, I love that insecurity. They're not there. But part of it, I think, is asking the questions, having the conversations on their terms and with their terminology, finding that common ground for where we do have shared interests. And those can be very successful conversations.
This is actually a couple of answers to a question that's related regarding funding for science and continued research and anything related to climate and environmental field. The one that I like the best is directed to Mr. Thomason. It says, economies are technology driven today, yet it seems our modern day dictators want to bet are defunding and deporting and harassing scientists. Does this mean that in this day and age, dictatorships are self-limiting? A lack of scientists will cause the regimes to break down, perhaps? And the related question was, how will scientists fund projects without government funding assistance? Without more funding, how can we hire people for projects? How does the frequency of hurricanes lower? Oh, this is more specific. Anyway, I'll leave like that. Chris, you want to say something?
Okay, so we have the long arc of societal rise and fall. I recommend studying Rome. I think we have to understand that Project 2025, which is what we're seeing implemented, is based on the idea that government has no role doing these things. It's the fundamental belief that we need to go back to the late 19th century, where we had a tiny federal government, where federal government hardly did anything besides run the army and run diplomacy, that there was no income tax, there was no FBI, there was no Department of Labor, no Department of Education, no Department of Energy. And they really, it's really a conservative philosophy that government has no role in any of this. That if you want science, that it's up to philanthropists and it's up to individuals, but it's not the role of government to take money from the citizens and redeploy that somewhere else. And if you are a citizen of the 20th century, you grew up with this idea that, oh my God, cancer is horrible. Maybe we should spend some tax money learning about cancer. Oh wow, wouldn't it be cool if we knew that hurricane was coming 4 or 5 days in advance rather than waking up one morning and seeing the clouds on the horizon? And so we invested in a national, in a NOAA, in a National Weather Service. For the people who are running the country today, all of this is antithetical. It is beyond what the role of government should be. And that is why they are committed to dismantling these things. It's not that they hate, it's not that they want more cancer, or they want more measles, or that they want to be, they want us all to be surprised the next time a tornado comes through. It's just they don't think that's the that's the federal government shouldn't do those things. And it is a philosophy that has been in America going back to the know-nothings in the 1820s, 1830s. This is an intellectual strain that has always been part of our politics. But whereas we had Dwight D. Eisenhower mocking the John Birch Society, and which was the one of the antecedents to Project 2025 and what we see today, it really is a fundamental difference in what we see the role, how we see the role of government. And the big thing is, the people who voted for this regime did not know what they were voting for. They did not know this was the deal. President Trump told us that Project 2025, he had nothing to do with it, and that none of that was going to come true. So I do, you know, I know some people voted for this government expecting this. I am willing to wager that the majority of people who voted for this did not sign up for this, and that is something we have to keep in mind.
Thank you. One last question I want to bring up here is somebody asked, and I think this is didn't say who to go to, but it makes sense that Dr. Bungie be the person might know something about this. What will the effect of larger insects, mosquitoes, carrying more diseases be on our Southeast Texas human population?
Yeah, no, this is actually a project I'm working on right now. So, especially in the Houston area, we are home to 3 of the most potent vector-carrying mosquitoes, or mosquito subspecies in the U.S. And if we see a heating climate, that can have a few different effects on mosquito populations. Increasing heat and increasing rainfall may increase still water. That would in turn lead to larger reproductive rates of mosquitoes and lead to larger populations. But on the other hand, if we have extreme heat events, that could kill off mosquitoes. So the actual impact is still kind of debated, and it's something that we're looking at currently and trying to create a forecast model for Harris County, specifically for these 3 different mosquito species. But generally, once you increase the populations, then the female vectors can ultimately distribute vector-borne diseases more effectively across the Gulf of Mexico. And one thing that we're looking at is if those populations come to a certain like critical value, will we see endemic cases of certain vector-borne diseases like malaria in the U.S.? So it's definitely a huge concern and something that we're thinking about when it comes to climate change.
Okay, thank you. We're going to have a panel. We'll start our next presentation. We've got three presenters. So that should be another, 20-something minutes or so. If we stay on schedule, so please don't go away. I'll have some summary comments and closing thoughts at the end, and we'll be open for discussion when anybody wants to talk about stuff. So appreciate your patience, and we're sorry about the technical difficulties and messed us up there a little bit. But I think hopefully. She investigates health risks linked to air pollution, extreme weather, and natural disasters. And her title is Tracking the Impact of Atmospheric Change on Human Health.
University of Texas School of Public Health. Well, before my talk, I have a question for you all. How many of you are familiar with NASA satellites? Especially Earth satellites? Yes, NASA satellites. Oh, many? Great. Because I was worried about, you may not be interested in this. Compared to the last panel, my talk is like a more data-based, like more technique, machine learning, AI-based. It's like a pure research. Okay, great. This is a slide about my background. So I have been studying climate science, environmental health, energy, especially renewable energy, for the past maybe 15 years. I have been in university for a century. Yeah, so my degree is like in atmosphere science, atmospheric oceanic science, and environmental resources, energy analysis and policy, and their training across the US. And because of COVID, my father actually, he is a clinician fighting COVID at front line. So at that time, I was very stressful. I cried a lot because at that time I was just studying pure science. Then I changed my career a little bit to public health. So since 2020, I have to work on applying atmosphere science, remote sensing, machine learning to promote public health, especially environmental health. And more specifically, it's about climate change and human health. So I spent several years at Emory University, Rolling School Public Health, located at Atlanta, and then moved to Texas in 2023. So I haven't been here for many years. So really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all today. And currently, I am a tenure-track assistant professor in environment and occupational health. And before joining UT, I did three fellowships, one with NASA at JPL, Jet Propulsion Lab at California, specifically about satellite observation climate models. Then I did another two fellowships funded by NSF about sustainable climate risk management. And more recently, I had a fellowship funded by NIH about disaster research with the University of Washington in Seattle. Okay, and this slide is about my research group. Including myself, we have 11 people all working on the climate change health related research projects. And I recruit people from different training backgrounds. For example, we have a medical doctor with a background in internal medicine, also have postdocs with training in computer science and environmental science, and they have graduate students, PhD students with training in epidemiology, global environmental health, public policy, biostatistics, city and regional planning, and also research interns for interest in climate health. Because climate change is really a complicated issue. We want to communicate people from different backgrounds to solve this challenge together. Okay, and this slide shows our research motivation, which is the atmospheric change is affecting everyone. For example, in the last panel, people mentioned the flooding, hurricanes, extreme heat in Houston. So it's affecting everyone. And also air pollution here in Texas. We breathe every second. And our research goal is to quantify the impact of short-term and long-term atmospheric change to promote environmental health. Specifically, I mentioned like some extreme weather, extreme heat, extreme precipitation, different air pollutants, like a PM2.5. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this term, which means the very tiny particles when you breathe can go deeply into your lungs and connect with a lot of health outcomes such as cancer, cardiovascular disease, and also natural disasters like hurricanes and wildfires as well. And we connect all of these exposures with health data together to study health disparities and environmental justice. For example, next month I'm going to give a talk at the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, talk about how air pollution influence health cancer disparities. And this slide shows that our previous project in Atlanta, because I was in Atlanta before, then this map shows that in figure A, and shows the Metro Atlanta, most the weather stations located in the south part of Atlanta, no, in the north part of Atlanta, very few in the south. So in this area, we lack of ground monitors to assess the health burden of exposures. And then figure C and C shows the high percentage people of color and the low life expectancy actually happens in the south of Atlanta. But we lack of data in this area. Then what's the solution? That's NASA satellites. So I have been working with NASA for over 12 years. I begin with several NASA satellite teams. For example, the one called CloudSense Calypso. I've been working with that satellite science team to use the satellite data to study the changes in Earth climate system. Then starting off 2020, I go to another science team called Terra Miser science team to study air pollution, to use the observations of satellite to predict ground level air pollution for different air pollutants. Then more recently, I have more collaborations with the Temple satellite and the Maya satellite. The Maya satellite in the yellow color here, actually that's the very first NASA investment for public health. And the first satellite mission to study air pollution in the health. So we are working hard on it. And this satellite is scheduled to launch next year in June. Yeah. If you're interested, you can search online NASA Maya, M-A-I-A. Okay, next slide shows our research methodology. So we combine, use machine learning techniques to combine the data from different satellites. It can be NASA satellites, NOAA satellites, or European satellites, or commercial satellites. And at the same time, we collect ground data from local sensors. For example, there is a local sensor called Purple Air. It's about like $200. If you buy that purple air, you can know the air quality around you. Some people install it at home, outside. That's local sensors. At the same time, we're using the atmospheric reanalysis data from NOAA or from NASA. And we'll combine all together to estimate different environmental exposures, for example, air pollution. Then connect with health data to provide assessment for different health outcomes, support decision making. And this slide shows the strength of our research strategy. We usually take advantage of two satellites. One is called low Earth orbit satellite. Another one is geostationary satellite. for the low Earth orbit satellite, we can monitor the Earth for the past more than 20 years. And we have been using this to estimate active Wi-Fi across the globe, like different countries. And the other one called geostationary satellites, mainly launched by NOAA, is keeping monitoring every corner of the US. So we are using this satellite to monitor, for example, the Wi-Fi smokes. And this is also related research. So there is a global effort called Lengthen Countdown. It's top one initiative about climate change health. So I have been using satellite data to provide predictions about Wi-Fi and contribute to this annual report. And because we use satellite data, we can study the climate change health effects under different countries, especially in low-income countries and under supported communities. And this slide shows our recent work. For example, we use satellite data about aerosol optical depth to estimate air pollution, then connect with the health data about cardiovascular disease. We also use the satellite data of the land surface temperature to estimate extreme heat, then study kidney disease. So these are some examples. And this is the next step. This is the upcoming satellite mission Maya to study air pollution health. And more recent years, funded by NASA, we got the opportunity to learn communities' thoughts regarding the climate change health and environmental justice. So we go to the under-resourced communities in Atlanta and understand their needs, build an exposure model for them, then connect with health data. And this is some slide summarize the current work in my research group. And that's the end. Thank you.
Very interesting. Another health-related presentation will be given by Dr. Lance Calvert, who is the Program Director for the Environmental and Public Health Education and Engagement Facility at UTMB. He is the Engagement Manager. And you're going to be talking about environmental health and climate change.
He's doing the work with the Carter Center down there with the world.
Hello, everybody. This is Doug here, and I just wanted to, I was told that we didn't really get the word out. We have two sets of door prizes, and some people signed up, and some people didn't. We got this really good book called Fire Weather, and it's one that the Citizens for Environmental Coalition is doing as a special project, and also Hummingbird Peter. So if you didn't do it, I'm going to pass these cards out, and you can sign up. And at the end here, we'll do the draw.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
This should be fairly short because most everybody has covered a lot of the topics that I was going to talk about. So I'm going to switch it up just a little bit and try to approach this more along the lines of community engagement and the idea that we need to make our communities more resilient. So as I go through this, I'll go a little bit faster because you've heard a lot of it already. Okay, so this first slide is basically saying that there is a critical point between environmental health and climate change. Okay, most of us know a lot of the things that we're talking about as far as climate change, that we are looking at sea level rise as a strong possibility of happening. Flooding, we are seeing all across the nation. Heat stress issues that we've been seeing in the newspaper. Stronger storms, droughts, and the storms themselves are actually coming up and starting up very, very much faster than they usually do. Environmental health. So what is environmental health from our standpoint? That is anything that will be given an adverse effect on the health of the population or the community that we're studying. Things like pollution. So you've heard a lot this evening about air, water, and soil pollution. Okay, particularly in the Houston area, we get inundated for it with all kinds of pollutants. Chemical exposures, another big one. As you saw on my first slide there, I'm manager of the Inhalation Toxicology Corps as well. So what we end up doing there is looking at the effects of environmental pollutants on animal models and translating those findings into human health consequences. Natural disasters, again, you've heard a lot of about the hurricanes, about the wildfires, and the flooding that goes on. Okay, so we've heard about climate change, but what's the difference between climate change and weather? By the definition of the environmentalist is that weather is what's happening right now. Climate change, on the other hand, is long-term changes in weather patterns, and these are occurring across the globe. The health impacts that we can see, again, has been mentioned, heat stress. This is a very big one because it generally affects the older populations. It also affects those that are unhoused. Okay, so those are the two populations that we are most concerned with in our community engagement course. Flood, water security, again, food security is a big issue in Galveston Island. Water supply is also dwindling all across Texas. When you have loss of these two sources, then we're going to have issues with disease and with waterborne diseases. Our hurricanes, again, the history that we've seen some of, Hurricane Rita, for example, we lost 90 people. And that was not because of the storm, but that was because of the evacuation that we did. Okay? And of course, unfortunately, those were elderly people that were being transported from a home to a safe area. Okay. Hurricane Ike. The issue with Hurricane Ike, or the example that I'm going to give you today, is that when Hurricane Ike happened in 2008 on there, Galveston Island was hit pretty well from Hurricane Ike. Okay, it affected UTMB, the medical center there, very badly. Okay, part of the issue that happened there is that Hurricane Ike pushed the water surge up the bay, which again, most of you know about. But what happened is when the water started to recede, the northern part of the island is actually lower. It doesn't have the seawall. And so the storm surge came backwards onto the island. And in coming from that direction, it picked up the legacy pollutants that were in the sediment in the bay and ended up depositing them on the island. So we did research in that area, looking at the types of chemicals that might have come up. We ended up finding extreme levels of arsenic. So Galveston Island became contaminated
from that one hurricane with arson. Harvey. I loved Harvey. I was in the middle of the flood area. So Harvey, 52 inches of rain in a 2-day period. We end up affecting 100,000 homes, and we totaled cars completely out of that one. Okay, so this comes to the more important part, I guess, from my talk, is that as a committee engagement corps, one of the things that we are trying to build in our meetings with communities is community resilience. Okay? So what is community resilience? Well, basically it boils down to what do we have, what resources do we have that we can use to recover from, what resources do we need, how do we adapt to these things. Okay, for example, in another study that we did concerning the Hurricane Katrina, on there, one of the fishing communities that we worked with there decided that they weren't going to put up with losing their homes every time a hurricane came in and having to wait around for government to come and give them money to restore their homes. So as a community, they ended up buying supplies way ahead of time and storing those. So the community as a whole were helping each other rebuild their homes and forgetting about waiting for government to show up. So the strategies then basically infrastructure, we've got aging infrastructure all across the nation. So we have to upgrade our infrastructure. Emergency planning, that's something that UTMB does all the time. Okay. Every year we get ready for hurricane, the whole UTMB community. Communities need to do the same thing, okay, as communities. What is it that you're lacking in case a hurricane hits your area? Electricity is probably one of the big things that you need to have. Materials to recover, because again, one of the things that ends up happening with communities during hurricanes when they're hit, if you're damaged, you have to wait for people to come back and repair your homes, and you have to wait for the federal government to bring you money. So these are the things that we can do to try to change in order to increase resilience. And so since I'm coming close to out of time, okay, this will be my, last one here. Okay, so what is going to take? Well, again, what I'm doing as community engagement, coming to you to give you what knowledge I have on communities, but I have to come to you as far as getting the questions. What is it? What are the questions that you have? What are the things that we can do together to help build resilience in your communities? Okay, one of the other projects that we work on, for example, is lots of the research that we do in disaster response is that we don't have what is known as a baseline for biological testing. Okay, so we have started a biorepository for what we're calling our sentinel people. Okay, so that when a disaster does hit, we will then go back to our sentinels to get samples if they're in within the area of the disaster. And then since they are the sentinels, we already have a baseline set of points that we can use, and then we can compare those to what has happened to them at that point. Okay, I'm sorry it took so long for a short thing that I was skipping over, but I thank you for your attention.
concept of sentinel people is basically where you're using a person instead of a pond or a location or whatever to assess change. That's pretty interesting. And also the concept about people helping each other, you know, not depending on the federal government, because that takes forever to get there. I had a good friend that lived in Bay St. Louis, and he went through Katrina, and he was showing me all the community. He said, "You see that house there? I built it with my neighbors." He said, I have my brother-in-law who just waited for the government, and he's still waiting. He said, "Well, all of us just got together and like good neighbors helped each other." And I thought that was amazing. I mean, it was amazing what they did. There was people that liked it so much from Boston and New York that decided to move down there afterwards. Because the neighborly community. So anyway, that's pretty interesting stuff. Okay, we have one last presenter. He's going to be talking about a topic that's near and dear to everybody's heart, is home insurance premium increases in the legislature. This is Mr. John Covarrubias, and he's an advocacy chair for the Bay Area Democrat movement. He's a career, also retiree from NASA.
If you would like to stay abreast of this topic, go to that website there. I have a newsletter that I put out, and I only send something out once every 2 weeks or so. It's and I'll tell you about the bills that are being debated in Austin. I'll keep you in tune with this issue.
Jack it up.
And you get one.
Yeah, right there.
tinyurl.com/BayAreaHouston. As I said, I was a consumer advocate from 1995 to about 2010. If you remember, in 2010, the Tea Party came in and they wiped out all of our moderate Republicans. And these were the guys that we were talking to, along with the Democrats. And at that time, I decided to step back. I recently came back to tackle the rising cost of home insurance. All right, here we go. Okay, climate change. Guess who believes in climate change? Guess. It's the insurance companies. You know, and you're paying for it too. So, in hearings in Austin, and when you read articles in the Houston Chronicle, by the way, the Houston Chronicle is doing a series of stories on the rising cost of insurance. Great stuff, great information. They will never say the two words climate change. Instead, they say frequency and intensity of storms. Well, what the hell is that? It's climate change. These are code words. You read it, you'll hear it, you see them at the hearings, you talk to our elected officials and their staff, they will never say climate change. They will always say frequency and intensity of storms. For decades, they have ignored this issue. For decades. And now they're using it as an excuse to raise your premiums. I don't know about you guys, but they have raised my premiums.
Yeah.
In fact, Doug and I were in Austin talking to the members of the insurance committee. And halfway through the day, I got an email from my insurance agent, and it raised my premiums went from $6,000 a year to
$9,000.
And I'm one of the lucky ones. There are people who are hurting even more than I am. So if, as one of the speakers said, if climate change is over, then why are our premiums continuing to go up? Now realize this is not a partisan issue. It affects everyone. Home buyers, home sellers, your property owners, your schools. CCISD's insurance went from $3 million a year to $6 million. In just two years, folks. So not only are you getting hit in your pocketbook paying your premiums, you're getting hit in your with your taxes also. Let me give you some not so fun facts. about the Bay Area. So, this area, House District 129, we have the highest premiums in the state. Our elected officials have ignored the insurance problems for decades. In 2003, they reformed insurance, big reform, and they were going to use the power of the free market. And all that did was the insurance companies were free to leave the market, because that's exactly what they have done. So they've also ignored climate change. The insurance companies have pulled out of our area. As an example, the lobby group that you'll see in Austin always testifying against the bills, the Texas Coalition for Affordable Insurance Solutions, they represent six of the biggest companies in the state of Texas. Five will not do business in House District 129. Only one will, USAA. They wanted $15,000 from me. $15,000 for my house that I was paying $6,000 for. So USAA, Farmers, State Farm, Allstate, Texas Farm Bureau nationwide, none of them will write new policies in this area. And that's just the top six. I asked the TDI yesterday, Texas Department of Insurance, give me a list of all the insurance companies. They say there's 146 companies doing business in Texas. I said, give me a list. They didn't have one. And they said, go through a Freedom of Information Act of public records. I did. They came back and said, go to this website. It's all there. It wasn't there. So, let me tell you, it concerns me. Our state representative has been on the insurance committee in the House for 10 years. And look at us now. We have the highest premiums in the state. Our state senator is on the business and commerce committee, and they hear all the insurance bills. He's no longer running. He won't be our state senator. He is now going to move on to Texas Attorney General. Our state rep is running now for senator. But you got to ask them, what the hell have you been doing for the last 20 years or so? So, now we know that climate change it's been around for decades. We've been talking about it for decades. But over the last 30 years, what has Texas done about it? They knew it was coming. They knew it was coming. So what do? You reduce the risk. You think of ideas, you come up with solutions that when a storm does hit, your house is not going to be demolished, or it's not going to have a lot of repairs needed. Other states like Alabama, you don't hear about Alabama. You don't have any problems like after a hurricane or so, because they started a program called Fortify. And this was 15 years ago. And the state helps homeowners fortify their houses and protects them from storms. What has the state of Texas done? Not a damn thing. Nothing. They have ignored this issue. So now we are being pushed into a program called the Texas Fair Plan. It's not a good plan, and it's not fair. In fact, that's the one I just moved on to. It's a state-sponsored program, much like the Texas Windstorm. That's the Texas Windstorm Insurance Association. And they cover 14 counties along the coast. Now, what happened is that the insurance industry fled the market, and they pulled out of that area. The state has taken over. Now they're pulling out of our area. And guess what? The state's going to take over. You know what that's called? Socialized insurance. That is what they're pushing us to. The great free market of the state of Texas is pushing us into socialized home insurance. And quite frankly, at this point, I would take that, because at the very least, they will be open and they will tell you how much money they have, how much money they spend, how much money they need. So, and the bottom line in all this is this is what happens when you ignore science. You heard all the science people up here today. When you ignore science, what happens? We lose. And let me just say, on a good note, sort of, we have an individual who is running for a state representative. He announced last week One of the things he's going to run on is a rising cost of home insurance. So I think we got their attention, and hopefully we'll get their attention in November too. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to welcome the other members of this last group of presenters to come sit up here, and we'll be providing, we'll be asking some questions. Doug. Oh, we're collecting them now, the cards. For a few, a minute there, I want to just say that about the science, this, whoever said it earlier about the code words for climate change, having been a state employee for many years prior to being a professor and then still being involved with a lot of coastal issues, I can say that there for a while, that was a dirty word. That was scrubbed from all reports. You had to talk code, present that in the environmental field. And I'm talking about agencies like the General Land Office, TCEQ, all these agencies, and it was terrible. And so we had to find secret ways to get information out. And there's still a lot of that going on. So anyway, I have to speak up. So Haley, you got any questions? What has research shown to be the damage being done to our health from microplastics in the food and water that we eat and drink? Kind of a little off topic, but here you go. You want to try to make a shot at it?
Huge issue.
There is a lot of pollution from these storms.
From a very small piece. A lot of the research is indicating that we have already got a body burden of microplastics. We're getting it from food packaging. We're getting it from water that we're drinking. We're inundated with microplastics. Health-wise, we don't have a complete picture, but microplastics are interfering with some of the biochemical pathways that we're utilizing in cell.
Okay, next question is, thank you. What policy change do you believe would it make the greatest change in our footprint as a state in regards to climate change? I guess that's me.
They're going to make me answer this one. All right. I think it again deals with the types of fuels that we're using for our power generation. We have issues with releasing CO2 from fracking. The use of fossil fuels for driving our cars. We like to think that e-vehicles are very good because we're not supposedly polluting, but then you have to think on the other side, where is the electricity we're coming from? Is it coming from a coal plant? Is it coming from the windmills? One of the other things that you can do personally is look at your power plant, your electrical plant, okay? See, they should be able to tell you where they're getting their electricity. They'll give you a percentage that, 15% or 20% is coming from fossil fuels, 10% is coming from wind, okay? So
you can actually go to these companies and ask them, where is your electricity coming from? So you can make a change that way.
Thank you. Another question is, where are the Sentinels located? What is their area of study? Or what is your area of study?
All right. Well, the first cohort, I'll put it that way, the first cohort that we have recruited are mailing individuals around the Texas City, Galveston area. We currently have 69 Sentinels that we have information on. There our Sentinels have done a great job of giving us medical history. We've taken biophysical physiology measurements, in other words, height, weight, blood pressure, A1C levels, and they've been kind enough to give us actually body fluids, blood, sputum, hair samples, that type of thing that we are biobanking against, that we can then turn around and use biological tests to determine any kind of changes in those tissues from an exposure. So we are planning on doing future cohorts to build our biobank in addition to repeating some of our Sentinels, because again, we have to take into account the length of time that these samples are being stored. So if there's any changes from the storage, we want to keep track of that as well.
Have you experienced or heard residents express concerns about toxic waste releases caused by extreme weather events in our area?
What's the question? Could you repeat again?
Have you experienced or heard residents express concerns about toxic waste releases caused by extreme weather events? I guess floods, hurricanes. Oh, here.
More related to air, but for the pollutants in the water, I know my colleagues, they are collaborating with NASA to use the satellite monitor the color change in the water, especially around the communities, to detect change and put this data together to understand how this pollutant in water has been changed after the hurricane and what the status before the hurricane.
I could throw in my two cents. Having worked with, like I said, various agencies over the years, the answer is yes, there's big concern. And it can, because when you have a big storm event, you can have a flush of all kinds of stuff down the storm sewers. I've seen being parked underneath the bridge down in the ship channel years ago, dark fluid just come out of the storm sewer within seconds. I mean, literally seconds, we just happen to have our instruments in the water to see oxygen just go zoom. Fish jump out of the water. I'm not talking about swimming to the side, they jump. They start, they're dying. And you know, how many times that happened and nobody notices? Because we just happen to be at the right place at the wrong time. So anyway, they're just saying, yeah, I think it's a big concern for a lot of people because things wash off the ground and chemical facilities are just like anything else.
And then even at the point in time when they actually do the testing, it's sometimes beyond the event, so it's like nothing going on here.
Yeah. And it's a difficult thing to capture because it is unpredictable when it happens. What can this area expert in risk mitigation, what is this area expect in terms of risk mitigation when you look at the location in the state of Texas? Of its location in the state of Texas.
Yeah.
In reference to like risk mitigation for protecting your home and fortifying your home so that it's not damaged during the storm, you know, as I said, the state of Texas hadn't done a thing, you know, and they are just recently beginning to realize that we have to do something. They have a bill currently that they're debating, something similar to Alabama called Fortify, but unfortunately, all it says is that if you pay to fortify your house, then you pay to fortify your house. That's it. I mean, seriously, there's no deduction in your premium, there's no required better coverage, nothing. So it's something we're watching. I mean, if I continue doing this, I'd be watching that. I think the other thing, the best thing for risk mitigation is get elected officials that will come and talk to you and will listen to us, because this is not, until recently, this issue is not on the map for them. Climate change is not on the map for them. And the insurance issue is not on the map also.
I think that's all the questions, and I'd like to offer just a quick summary. Some key points that were brought up. One of the big things that brought up early was how we're losing experts, or reduction of expertise to handle this very complex problem. It is very complex. Everything's just interwoven. I mean, it's amazing. I used to teach present a thing on water quality about the whole watershed and how something way up here affects it down here, and numerous feedback mechanisms. The other thing that I'm going to throw in there is there's an opportunity for good collaboration between different disciplines, because what affects human health also affects environmental health. But there are two different groups here in our silos, unfortunately. And what Dr. Zuno here with satellite imagery and using that technology for human health applications is a good example of cross-fertilization of those disciplines. You know, satellite technology and epidemiology, basically. And we need a lot more of that. Same thing with all these health diseases, mosquito ecology. Well, that's ecology and public health combined, you know, because mosquitoes are just another aquatic insect. We also need, there's concern about autocracy or one-party rule, and how that leads to, I guess, funnel vision, where people they don't want to like some idea, they don't want to deal with it, they can just say no, that's not what we're focused on. With nobody pushing, because that's how our democracy works, it's not going to happen. The stuff that Mr. Stokes presented on dolphins in Galveston Bay is another example where there's some opportunities. You probably don't know, but Galveston Bay, we did a study a few years back. We collected all kinds of data on contaminants in Galveston Bay. Dolphins, which are a marine mammal, like even they're mammals like us, and so they would be a great sentinel creature, I think, for a lot of stuff that gets discharged around here. But we don't interact. I mean, that's everybody's fault, because everybody's in their silo, like trying to get tenure or whatever. You know, they only get funding from external agencies and organizations if they do research in their area. So there's a lot of institutional breaks too. And some of the feedback mechanisms that Bob brought up involving sea level rise and things like oyster predators is a good example of how the impact on the environment is affecting not the oysters necessarily, but the pathogens that eat the oysters. And so conversion, freshwater, saltwater, wetlands, and the Ike Dike. I was involved with some of the studies that were done for that, and that was a little too late trying to deal with a problem with instead of looking at all the potential solutions, just looking at one solution. And I'm not saying anything against engineers, but engineers, it's like, you know, you have a hammer, you work with a hammer, everything needs to be nailed. If you look at other things, you tend to look at it a different way. And you didn't ever, never, ever want to criticize an engineer. And that's not based on what I saw in Ike Dike, but what I saw years ago when I used to have a film that I showed in my classes, and it was about the Mississippi River lock system. And they have this elaborate system, and you know, to help with flooding and everything. And there's, and of course, it's caused all kinds of disasters on the Delta, and increased erosion and so forth. But I told, I said, watch the way that the biologist talks about it versus the engineer. And the engineer, when he brought up the system, he started going into all the details. Oh, they could divert this, divert that. I said, you see that? That's his baby. Before you argue with an engineer, just remember, that's his baby. You know, he created it, and you got to respect that, because he was given a mission, and he did it. He is an evil guy, just doing his job. But kind of meeting him halfway and understanding where their respect is coming from. Doesn't mean what they did was right. But, yeah. Anyway,
I have a question. I wondered if you would be comfortable telling folks about what's going on over UHW.
Oh, just like a lot of other things going on these days, you know, funding for education is declining, especially anything having to do with environmental science. The funding for example, the organization I used to work for, Environmental Institute of Houston, has been declining, and they have a mixture of state funding and soft funds, and they hustle every year, you know, like any other university, and that's being cut. And also, you know, there's environmental science programs, environmental management programs. The environmental management program, I heard the other day, was not going to be refunded. And it was two of the employees who were taking their early retirement, and there's an interest in trying to reduce the budget deficit or something like that. So they're trying to cut, you know, cut staff and faculty, and it happens to be one of them. Now, is it coincidental? I don't know. I'm not at that level of knowledge. Same's happening in the environmental science program, because they're seeing reductions in funding. And one thing that amazes me, again, it doesn't matter to me, I'm retired now, but you know, you have an environmental institute that was created by the citizens. It was not something that they came up with. It was industry and conservation groups coming together and saying, we need to have an institute that does this kind of work. And we have support by the state representatives and everything else, and this and was very well supported. And so over the recent years, started to climb. And I don't know, it just, to me, it's a no-brainer, but what do you want to know?
About half staff.
About half staff. So if you contact your legislators or anybody else, ask them about your colleges and universities and so forth in your district, and say, hey, what's going on with these guys? Are you trying to support them? Because universities are getting beat up right now big time. And it's because, you know, people perceive us to be biased, and we're not. I mean, in order for me to publish anything on climate change, anything, it goes through all kinds of scrutiny. And I mean, scientists, they love to beat up on each other, I guarantee. And I'm not getting paid by anybody, big money.
Just piggybacking off something that you had said before, how we need to have more collaboration between different
disciplines. Yeah.
So we've got like three different here currently, and you just spoke about how environmental science is essentially being defunded,
yeah.
And at the college level, those students are going to need to find vocations to work after that.
Yeah.
And there's no funding for environmental work specifically. Trying to rehabilitate the environment. So you work mostly off of volunteer, which I think is, you know, not the solution, because the passion is there, but they'll need to have, they'll need to pay the bills. So how can we facilitate collaboration between these disciplines, and how can we create jobs, because we've got government, we've got public health, and we've got state science.
Well, we had some jobs, they disappeared recently. At the federal level.
I understand that, but what are we doing locally?
Well, I know, but that's the state level.
Yeah.
You know, so, I don't know what they're planning, but you know, they review agencies like Parks and Wildlife and DCQ all the time.
Yeah, that's the question, though. How do we try to facilitate that?
Yeah, I'm sorry. me, the only thing you really should do is talk to your representatives and react politically, whatever way you believe, you know. And I don't believe in politics being a dirty word. I believe in that's just human nature. That's how we make deals, you know. Whether it be at the family level, you have family politics, you got inter-family politics. And so, you know, that's just human nature. There's nothing wrong with it. But I mean, if it's your world you live in,
sorry, but we're
going to
have to call it a night.
But I'm glad y'all came up. Thank you.
Ready now.